I can't see the light. It makes no difference how you're waving the flag. It's all just a power dance. No, no war. Enough to do here, why can't they see? It's time better spent, it's no mystery. No, no war.
Thank you for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up next, Occupy the Courts, a conversation with Lawrence Lessig and Chris Hedges. Lawrence Lessig and Chris Hedges met in front of the Occupy TVNY's camera to discuss their vision of change.
I have enormous respect for what you've done, but don't stop with this symbol of corporations are not persons. Don't stop until you've restored this democracy to a democracy that the classical Republicans could respect, a democracy where we think not about ourselves, but what is in the common good.
In every single avenue, we have to fight back, however corrupt the courts are, and certainly on the streets. But you're an inspiration to me, you're an inspiration to countless Americans, and I think ultimately because the truth is on our side and justice is on our side, we will prevail.
I'm here with Chris Hedges and Lawrence Lessig, who've joined us today, the Occupy the Courts team, to talk about issues of corporate personhood and reform in our current system or outside of it in connection with a corporate personhood event that's taking place today in Foley Square in New York City. So I thought I'd just like to start by asking you both, what brings you to the event today, the corporate personhood event? What in your work has brought you to the place that you're interested in this event and think it's an important one to be engaging in right now through Occupy or otherwise? I guess I'll start with Professor Lessig. Mr. Hedges.
Well, I think that the anniversary the day of infamy that we're celebrating tomorrow, the anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United, is an extraordinarily important moment to rally people to recognizing the wide range of reform that's necessary. I'm not somebody who believes that reversing Citizens United gets us to utopia in American democracy. I think American democracy was broken before Citizens United shot it once again. The body was already dead and cold. But it is a moment because many people recognize the absurdity in the decision and the consequences of the decision, and that's the energy we need to rally if we're going to ever reform it and reverse it and take the other steps that are necessary.
We've undergone a corporate coup d'etat in slow motion, and it's over. We've lost, and they've won. And the fundamental message of the Occupy movement, which is often criticized for not having demands or having a message, is that they want that coup reversed. And once that coup is reversed, then everything falls into place. Healthcare, affordable housing, sustainable energy, local banking. But if you don't shatter that corporate monolith, then all of the reforms that we seek, none of them will come into place. And so by focusing on that issue, on the corporate state, on what the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin calls our system of inverted totalitarianism, by which he means that it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. That in inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to the Constitution, electoral politics, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet internally have seized all of the levers of power so as to render the citizenry impotent. And this is the issue. Citizens United is a manifestation, as Professor Lessing has pointed out, of a disease that has destroyed the body politic for some time. But it's a pretty flagrant manifestation of that.
So do you agree that there's been a coup and that it's over?
Well, I do agree that politics in America has been captured by the tiniest slice of America. 0.26% of Americans give more than $200 in a political campaign. 0.05% give the maximum amount in a congressional campaign. 0.01%, one out of 1,000, give more than $10,000 in an election cycle. Those are the people with the influence inside of our political system. Though I agree it's important to address the question of corporate personhood and to get that resolved in the right way, if that's all we did, those people would still control American politics in a way that would make American politics still unresponsive to all the issues that I think people on the left and even people on the right want American government to be able to address. So I think that it's absolutely essential that we get people to recognize the way this system is captured by not the 1%, by the fraction of the 1%. And until we reverse that, the system has no claim to being called a representative democracy.
So how does it get reversed?
Let me just add on that it's not just the political system that has been seized by the corporate state. It's the systems of communication, it's education, it's culture, with an assault against those traditional liberal institutions that once made incremental and piecemeal reform possible. Labor unions, public education, and in particular great universities like City University, which have been decimated. You go to places like Harvard or Princeton, where I've taught, and they are run as corporations. The whole process of standardized testing, the winnowing out, the celebration of a very narrow analytic kind of intelligence embodied in figures like Lawrence Summers, it is exactly what the corporate state wants. So that by the time you reach these elite institutions, you're perfectly molded and of course, incredibly deferential to authority. Indeed, most students at these institutions, by the time they get there, allow authority to define their success. And they are funneled into the system to work as systems managers. That's all they know how to do, is serve that system. The whole withering away of the humanities. And I just spoke at Harvard, where I went to graduate school, and there is certainly a very heavy push to turn Harvard into the Stanford of the East Coast, i.e. a giant technical university with a vast medical research center, everything else, and let the humanities atrophy. And this is writ large across the country. Of course, for-profit universities don't even provide humanities. And there is a huge difference between teaching people how to think, which classics do, and you're a classics major, and teaching people what to think. And we teach less and less people how to think. So we can't look at it as just a corruption of the political system. These corporate forces, I mean, half of the trustee board of any university, including Harvard, with Robert Rubin, who sits on the board of overseers, should be in jail. And these institutions celebrate that kind of money. The presidents of these institutions are judged solely on their capacity to raise money. Of course, they're paid like overcompensated CEOs. So we're talking about a degeneration, not just within the political system, but throughout the entire culture. The real debate is being carried out by groups like Occupy. But it's not, the struggling with the issues that actually mean something in the daily lives of Americans are almost virtually absent from the commercial airwaves.
So let me ask you, Professor Lessig, I mean, Chris Hedges just said that it's not just about the corrupting influence of money in politics, but there's a pervasive corrupting influence, and it goes really deep. You've proposed certain reforms, or I'm not sure if that's the right word for them, to excise money from politics. Do you see that as the main issue? Do you recognize what Hedges is saying about this broader issue? Do you think your solution would address that broader issue?
I think that there's a sequence of reform. I completely agree about the way in which many institutions have been corrupted by a similar dynamic. I run an ethics center at Harvard that is focused on institutional corruption, which is this problem we see in government, but in every private institution you can imagine, including the academy. So I completely agree with that. But democratic politics was about the space where we could self-consciously decide how to make and remake a society. And if we can't reclaim that, we can't reclaim any of it. So I wouldn't disagree with the extraordinary range of work that has to be done across the spheres of society. But I think we actually have a moment and an opportunity where we could rally enough forces, this kind of diverse outsider forces. And they're not even left-right. It's outsider-insider. That's the fundamental division. Enough. We could rally them in the way Hobbes thought of the sovereign as the sleeping giant. The sleeping giant can be awoken. And when the giant awakes, can reclaim enough power to fix a part of it and then begin the long work that will be required to fix all of it. So I think it's a sequence question, not a disagreement about what the ultimate problem is.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
On Wednesday, we had the internet blackout and the sort of large movement against SOPA and PIPA, the internet piracy bills, where millions and millions of people signed petitions and many people called Congress. Is that the sort of sleeping giant awakening that you're talking about?
You know, spring comes in waves, and we've seen a whole series of these waves. And this is the latest. It's not, I mean, it was very impressive. It's not as impressive as what Occupy was. But we can talk about all of them. And you can see the way each time they happen, people begin to have a recognition that, you know, it's like the giant feeling the twitching of the fingers, and, oh my gosh, I have a hand over here, and then I have legs, and I slowly begin to see how I can coordinate and begin to do things. So each of them is important. None of them has yet put it all together, but I think we're on that in that direction, because the underlying cause of any of these things is not going away. You know, so that.
And what is that underlying cause?
Well, in my view,
I'm going to ask you the same question.
In my view, the underlying cause here is a deep corruption in many institutions, but let's just talk about the corruption inside of the government system, where because of the way in which we have embedded power, there's no connection to the original conception of a republic dependent upon the people alone. they're increasingly dependent upon funders, which, of course, are not the people. So there's this deep corruption inside the system that until we address cannot make democracy function. And until democracy functions, people are going to say, fuck democracy. Why should I waste my time with democracy? So people criticize the Occupy movement for not engaging. The Occupy movement is being deeply rational for not engaging in normal politics because normal politics gets us Barack Obama, right? Look at, I mean, what we thought in 2008, normal politics machine would work, we'd get the reformer, we'd be on our way back to happiness. But obviously we've seen it's gotten us nowhere.
So what, in your view, is the underlying cause?
The destruction of radical and populist movements, which began in World War I and culminated in the 1950s with communist witch hunts. So the Wobblies, the old CIO, the Communist Party, the anarcho-syndicalist unions, all of these are wiped out. And so you have a liberal class. The liberal class in any society has never been designed to be the left. It's designed to be the political center. The liberal class, it works as a kind of safety valve, so that when there are widespread grievances and injustices, as we saw during the Great Depression, you have traditional liberals within the establishment like Henry Wallace, Roosevelt's vice president, or Roosevelt himself, who give us the New Deal. And it's when Conrad Black writes his biography of Roosevelt, he said that Roosevelt's greatest accomplishment was that he saved capitalism, and that's right. Well, the destruction of those radical movements and then the disemboweling of liberal institutions. In the 1950s, you had thousands of university professors, directors, artists, writers, social workers. The social workers in this country, the union used to agitate on behalf of their clients. All of it's wiped out. Great figures like I.F. Stone can't get a job anywhere. Even at The Nation magazine, and starts I.F. Stone Weekly in his basement. And so essentially we were left defenseless. Movements, all of the correctives to American democracy came through movements that never achieved formal political power. The Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists for women's rights, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, and the destruction of those movements, coupled with a gutless liberal class, a kind of faux liberalism embodied in figures like Bill Clinton. I mean, what corporate giveaway did the Clinton administration not carry out? Whether it's deregulating the FCC or NAFTA or ripping down Glass-Steagall, the firewall between commercial and investment banks, again, the handiwork of Lawrence Summers, who Obama has just proposed to go to the World Bank. They speak in that traditional language of liberalism and yet betray every one of the sort of fundamental or core values that a liberal would embrace. And I think that that is emblematic of how deeply decayed the system is. And let me just finally say that the ideology that has been promoted by the corporate state, whereby we are supposed to kneel before the marketplace, that all human needs must be sacrificed because of the marketplace, defies 3,000 years of economic history and human nature. It's a utopian ideology, and it's been exposed as a lie. And I think that the death of that utopian ideology, which is becoming increasingly apparent not only to the American worker but to the global workforce, which is, of course, on this downward spiral where American workers are told that they have to be competitive on a global level with women who work in sweatshops in Bangladesh for 22 cents an hour or prison labor in China. It's the death of this utopian ideology coupled with the utter corruption of an extremely, as Professor Lessing pointed out, this incredibly tiny, narrow, oligarchic elite, which in my mind means the system is not reformable, but will have to be pushed aside. And I think that in that sense, the Occupy movement is, in sort of classical terms, correctly defined as a revolutionary movement.
So it seems a little bit like those two answers were talking past each other. You're talking about a mechanism whereby people's voices cannot be heard in the political system because it's been purchased. And you're talking, it seems like, about the consequences of that, this sort of the destruction of correctives to American democracy, perhaps by corporations who recognize them as threats.
No, I'm saying that I'm agreeing with Professor Lessing on the political aspect,
mm-hmm.
but I'm saying that the other avenues of public expression, for instance, the media, have been shut down. Opportunities of education are increasingly confined to the elite.
But can I, so to, just to interrupt you again, do you think, you said you don't think reform is possible, and why?
I don't think appealing to the systems of power will make the kinds of reforms that we want to see possible.
And do you see an attempt to extract money from politics as an appeal to those systems of power?
Sure, because it's got to pass through Congress. And the congressional, legislative branches, both at the state and federal level, are wholly owned subsidiaries of the corporate state.
So how, and maybe you could take a step back and explain a little bit of your project and say how you address that critique, which seems to be, you know, a very powerful one. How do you expect the captured powers to go along with you as you try and remove the influence of corporate money from politics?
So I'm not convinced that it's wrong to say that the existing Washington structure is unreformable. And in my book, I talk about, you know, the only outsider reform movement which the Constitution left open to us, which is a convention process.
Sorry, could you just say the name of your book?
So my book is Republic Lost. The framers in Article 5 say amendments can happen through Congress, and then somebody said, well, what if Congress is the problem? And they said, okay, fine. States can say, let's have a convention. The convention proposes amendments, and the amendments go through the states. And then the question is, to what extent really have the same powers that have taken over Washington taken over states? Chris might be right. I don't know. My view is, even if I think there's no chance, you got to do everything you possibly can to win. I don't really care, you know, whether he's right or not. It's not going to change what I think we need to do, which is this is the only path we have for trying to insert radical change into the system that doesn't depend upon congressmen voting on it. No congressman has to vote on this. So that's what I think we ultimately are going to
do. The only path being that you would convene an article, that you would convene a convention.
Article 5 convention that would, you know, symbolize and create enough political momentum around it that it would be very hard for people to stand down from it.
The morning is dead, and the day is due.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.